You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week, we'll hear from two of the writers behind The Shape of Water, which was developed simultaneously as a novel and a film. First up, New York Times bestselling author Daniel Krauss, who originally approached Guillermo del Toro with the story about a sea creature locked in a laboratory based on an idea he had when he was 15 years old.
I had this idea. It came to me sort of in a flash when I was, I think, around 15 or so. And it was very, very simple. There's a creature from a black lagoon-type creature in a lab. A night janitor finds it, establishes a relationship with it, and decides to break it out and take it home and put it in her tub.
And later we'll hear from screenwriter Vanessa Taylor, who co-wrote the film version of The Shape of Water and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay.
I am challenged every single time. I've never met the screenplay that was easy to write.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Daniel Krauss is a New York Times bestselling author who started his career as a documentary filmmaker. In 2015, he collaborated with genre director Guillermo del Toro on the novel Troll Hunters. Del Toro is best known for his dark fantasy films Pan's Labyrinth, Crimson Peak, and the Hellboy series. In March of 2018, the pair reteamed to release a novelized version of The Shape of Water, which was based on an original idea that Krauss had when he was 15 years old. The novel was developed at the same time as the Academy Award-winning film. I caught up with Daniel Krauss over the phone earlier this year. Clips of Shape of Water, courtesy of 20th Century Fox Film Corporation and TSG Entertainment Finance, LLC.
If I spoke about it, if I did, what would I tell you? I wonder. Would I tell you about the time? It happened a long time ago, it seems. In the last days of a fair prince's reign? Or would I tell you about the place? A small city near the coast, but far from everything else. Or, I don't know, would I tell you about her? The princess without voice. Or perhaps I would just warn you about the truth of these facts and the tale of love and loss and the monster who tried to destroy it all.
You were doing documentary work and now you're focusing really on your narrative fiction. So you're intersecting in that world all the time. Can you talk a little bit about riding that line and what you enjoy from both sides of it?
Generally, I do consider myself somebody who likes to work alone. It's part of what I carved out for myself when I was doing documentaries is I created a system in which I can make these movies almost entirely by myself. I would shoot them, I would edit them, I would do everything, and largely I would do it completely alone. So it's interesting that I've ended up doing now three collaborations, but I think it's also probably healthy. What you bring up that's so interesting is that it's been with filmmakers. You know, I've done two books with Guillermo del Toro, and now I'm doing this book with George Romero, and I don't really know what to make of that. I think my books sort of have a cinematic feel to them to some degree. I think they're visual, and they tend to involve set pieces, which translate well to film, I think. I mean, the funny thing is, it isn't like I went out and courted either of these filmmakers. They sort of, both of them in their own way, sort of came to me. So I think it was more like the filmmakers responding to my books rather than me responding to their films. In the case of Guillermo, he was a big fan of a book I wrote called Rotters, and that's sort of where our relationship started. I think he just, you know, read the book, saw a sort of kindred spirit, and when he was, you know, coming up with the idea for Troll Hunters, thought that I might be the right guy.
Can you talk about how the idea then of Shape of Water came about and what the kind of interesting roundabout way for that to get to the screen and now eventually be a book?
It's an interesting story. It's a very unique way that The Shape of Water has played out. Essentially, it was based on an idea I had as a teenager. So I had this idea. It came to me sort of in a flash when I was, I think, around 15 or so. I remember very well when the idea hit me, and it was very, very simple. There's a creature from a Black Lagoon type creature in a lab. A night janitor finds it, establishes a relationship with it, and decides to break it out and take it home and put it in her tub. So fast forward a couple decades or so, and that idea was, by the time I started writing books, was always sort of on the table as a potential book. It was always on the list, but it was never like one or two. It was more like four or five on the list. Most of my books really are ideas that have sat with me for 20 years or so. A lot of them are based on ideas that are really old. So it made sense that The Shape of Water would need 30 years or whatever, but I never really got to that point because of Guillermo getting involved. The very first time we met about Troll Hunters, he was up there shooting Pacific Rim, and we had breakfast together, a long breakfast where we talked about the book. For reasons I cannot tell you, conversationally it came up, and I said, oh, you know, I've always had this neat idea you might like. And so I told him just what I just told you, that couple sentences synopsis, and he said, that's beautiful. I think those were his words. So I kept trying to drag it back to Troll Hunters, flipping it back to The Shape of Water. And he started throwing out ideas and saying, well, you know, what if this? What if it had something to do with the Cold War? You know, within a couple minutes probably of me bringing it up, he said, I'm going to option this idea. This is my next movie. So that was a weird, exciting moment. But also, ideas get optioned all the time. I didn't really expect it to happen. And it really didn't for a while. His next movie went on to be Crimson Peak. And because I kind of thought it would never happen, I continued to sort of alone develop the idea. Again, it was not one or two on my list because I was writing other books at the time, but I was still developing it, occasionally jotting down some ideas. And then I guess it would be a couple years ago when suddenly the whole idea of the movie picked up a lot of steam and everyone was suddenly in touch with everyone. And it became clear that Guillermo really wanted to make this movie. So he said, well, how about we write it together? We'll write the book together. I'll make the movie, and everybody wins, and it would be kind of cool. We'll have this movie and book come out at the same time. And it was a really cool idea. It was a different idea. It's not really a novelization in any normal way. But in this case, it's much more complicated. It was my original idea that then he added to it with his idea, and then he developed the plot. But then I could take all this other stuff that I've been sort of jotting notes down for a couple of years and then fold that into his plot that he was coming up with. It's unusual. It's sort of this weird, you know, this very unique combination of both of our ideas. But to be clear, though, the book is Guillermo and I's, and the movie is his. I did not write the script because it was all happening so fast that I really needed to focus on the book because the book and the movie are being developed simultaneously. Originally, they were going to come out at the same time, but then there was thought that, well, maybe that's too much. And then the movie started getting, you know, it won Venice and started getting all this acclaim. So they were like, all right, let's do something that is almost never done. Let's have the movie come out before the book. Typically, the book comes out first, but I'm not really sure why that has to be. That's how people would generally find this book anyway. Even if it had come out first, they probably would still come to it via the movie. So the timing really didn't matter that much.
When you're developing a different project out of a similar idea, how do you separate the mind of the book from the movie, especially when the movie has had such critical and popular appeal?
It was easy, really, because the movie didn't exist when I was writing the book. I mean, it was being created, but there was no acclaim, obviously, because there was no movie. They were still making it. There was none of that pressure or none of that sense of the movie being somehow primary to the book, because most people thought this was going to be a really cool movie that Guillermo makes. But it is, at the end of the day, based on this bizarro idea about a woman and a fish man, and the chances of that becoming a huge like global phenomenon are pretty small.
So from an audience perspective, though, if somebody's seen the movie, they should still read the book because they're not going to be seeing the same project necessarily.
Generally, most of the plot points are the same, but not all of them. There's additional characters. There are characters that are very, very minor in the movie that are major in the book. There are themes that I was planning separately that I was able to weave in. So, yeah, I think you could watch the movie first and read the book, or read the book first and watch the movie, and it's going to feel like any other book and movie adaptation.
So let's talk a little bit about The Living Dead, which is the book that George Romero was working on and then passed away, so it's unfinished. And you were approached by, I guess, his estate, right, to finish this book.
Yeah.
How did that come about? You talked about them finding you. Does that give you a little pause here? I mean, he's so iconic.
The only job I've ever really been qualified for in my life is finishing this Romero book. Everything else I've done, I have not been qualified for it, but I'm really qualified for this. The first movie I ever remember seeing was Night of the Living Dead. Dawn of the Dead taught me about how movies can have subtext, how art can have subtext. These were critical texts to me. George was more than my favorite filmmaker. He was my favorite artist and possibly the reason that I was interested in any art. So to have this opportunity is an extremely exciting one, but it's also very moving to me. I've had such an intensely intimate relationship with his work for so long that a chance to contribute to it, to sort of escort his final work, is really an honor.
Well, so is this going to be finishing of a book and then a property that goes on to become a film afterwards?
There would be a certain irony to that. You know, George famously had troubles with the studio system in Hollywood. And even when zombies became a big thing with The Walking Dead and so forth, he could never really get studios to give him the big budgets. And the rare times that they did, he had really bad experiences. So he turned to this book to put down all of his really big ideas the studios would never fund. If the book does end up ever being turned into a movie, there's a sort of dark irony there.
Notice you really don't do screenwriting. Is there a reason why you've avoided jumping into that world of screenwriting, so like both feet, or?
When I sort of switched from doing documentaries to books, I really just wanted to focus on books to sort of get good at it. So there were opportunities that popped up over the years for screenplays, and I generally just turned them down. I had sort of a body of work that I wanted to establish in novels. All that said, I am working on a few different screenplays right now with various parties that I can't talk about. Yeah, so I am back in it now.
You did a lot of editing work. It seems like the editing might have been a great way of honing your storytelling skills. Did that work that way for you?
I mean, editing is possibly the most crucial part of writing. The question is, do you have the discipline to keep writing day after day, and do you have the discipline to edit? Because as any film editor knows, you watch the same few seconds over and over, hundreds of times. I think when you're crafting a story, whether it's writing or working with raw documentary footage, you are faced with the same question of dealing with your instincts to create a story, to shape a story from either raw footage that you filmed or raw ideas that you have. So there's some similarity there. I can't quite fully grasp it, but I know it's there. You know, in some ways, making the documentaries was sort of a pressure release from writing, I think, and vice versa. They operated from such different parts of the brain that I think they were more like cleaning up the palate more than anything else.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television. Ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. Listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with The Shape of Water author Daniel Krauss. When we left off, Krauss was discussing his newest novel, which is a posthumous collaboration with legendary Night of the Living Dead filmmaker George A. Romero. The Living Dead is scheduled to be released sometime next year.
one of my favorite creature feature movies of all time was Creature from the Black Lagoon. You know, what attracted you to that story? You know, it is a classic B movie. You know?
I think that Creature from the Black Lagoon is attractive to anyone who has developed or maybe overdeveloped sense of empathy, because the movie plays out like the creature is the bad guy. You're supposed to be rooting for these people who are hunting him, basically. But if you cut any, you know, tenderness in your heart, it is really difficult to watch that movie and not feel terrible for the creature. He's doing virtually nothing wrong. And these cruel humans come down and they just hunt him relentlessly and harpoon him and poison him. And I think as a kid, that's what drove the connection, is that I had sympathy for the creature. And I know that's exactly what drove Guillermo's connection. It's magical, really, that we, you know, this kid from Iowa and this kid from Mexico met up one day in Toronto and found out that they both had the same sort of obsession with this creature from a Black Lagoon who had been mistreated in the movie and sort of misunderstood in the popular imagination.
So in your imagination, this was really carrying what happened to that creature onto the next level.
If you take the creature from a Black Lagoon as gospel, and they defeat him at the end and presumably drag him back to the United States, well, then what? This beautiful creature who had been hurting nobody, maybe the last of his kind, is now in a lab somewhere in the U.S. What happens to him now? Is there some way we can narratively right that wrong?
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. While Daniel Krauss was working on the Shape of Water novel, Guillermo del Toro was writing a screenplay for the film version with Vanessa Taylor. Taylor has an extensive background in television, having written for Alias, Jack and Bobby, and Game of Thrones. I spoke with Vanessa Taylor at our 8th season On Story release at the beautiful KLRU studios in Austin, Texas.
Moment of your time. Today we are receiving a new team and asset here in T4. This is Dr. Robert Hofstetler from our sister facility in Galveston. Now, I don't want to bolster or overstate the matter, but this may very well be the most sensitive asset ever to be housed in this facility.
You were not intending, you were coming out of working at an investment bank, which of course we know would prepare anyone for Hollywood, right? So how did you go from that to this?
Well, I had always been interested in writing, but my impression was that writing was something you did as a hobby, that it wasn't possible to make a living. So my plan was to go to law school and write on the side. And then I was in LA and I was about to go to law school and I realized a couple things. One was I felt like I was too old to go back to school. And then I realized that you could get a job in television if you could get a writer's assistant job. So I didn't have any real contacts per se. But that's where my dad comes in. He saw an article in the Austin Statesman about Rob Thomas, who had just written his pilot for Cupid. And so I tracked Rob down and sent him a letter telling him how I had been such a great assistant in investment banking. We had this great conversation, and so he hired me, which was just a phenomenal stroke of luck. And the show ended up going, and so I ended up being his assistant on that. I asked him as a birthday present if he would let me share a script with him. And then after that year, if he would hire me on staff of his next show. And he did.
And his next show?
His next show was called Snoops, the short-lived but illustrious Snoops. Everyone quit that show. I was like the last woman standing, and they were actually trying to fire me. So it was a race to see if the show could get canceled before I got fired, and I won.
So how did that, because you're not planning on being a writer, and now all of a sudden you're on a show like Cupid, which was an incredibly unique show anyway at that time period. But can you talk about like how that started you rolling and what the direction it took you in?
Yeah, I mean, to have the opportunity to write the script with Rob and then to get to know all the other writers on staff who, of course, all have agents. I, of course, had no idea prior to that how I would get an agent. And so all of it meant sort of being an insider and suddenly having access to all that. It certainly opens all those doors. So it was a great opportunity.
Can you talk about how the idea came about for Jack and Bobby?
I was working with Greg Berlanti on Everwood, and that was a great experience. We had some awesome writers on that. Greg said to me, I'm doing this project, but I'm kind of too busy. Would you want to be involved with it? And Tommy, I guess, had been involved prior to that. And a couple of writers had sold this pitch about the idea of doing something about a young president. And then they were looking for some people who had some more TV experience to kind of come in and develop it. And that was a great experience. You know, we ran it together, and I found it actually to be a very challenging show to write, but I really enjoyed doing it.
So you were involved in a lot of shows that had really more of a lighter tone, and then Game of Thrones comes back. So I'd really love to hear how you got that call, what that was like, where they made the connection.
Yeah, I wasn't a natural fit necessarily. I'd read the pilot and just thought it was such beautiful writing. David Benioff and Dan Weiss are just phenomenal writers, and I was so impressed with it. And I had told my agent at the time and my manager, and I had just said, oh, I love this pilot. I think it's so great. And it turned out that they were looking to hire someone. They had actually kind of wanted to write that whole show pretty much themselves, and they've kept their writing staff very small. It's only 4 people per year, including them. We really got along, and I think they're very confident writers, and the fact that I hadn't written genre before did not scare them. I love the fact that they had so much confidence in all their people, and they were sort of like, this is your thing. You do it. Come back to us when it's done, you know? And you really had a lot of responsibility and a lot of autonomy. That was really cool.
And so you were talking about a little while ago that you were all essentially stuck in Northern Ireland together.
It was in Northern Ireland primarily, and then there were remote shoots in other locations. But so I was there, I guess my first season I was there for 3 months. I think both years I was there 3 to 4 months. And now, you know, subsequently they've been there much, much longer because the shoots have become more intense, more complicated. But yeah, so we were all just there in Belfast, which is sort of like a tiny town. You know, it sort of felt like being in sort of some small town in Wisconsin together. And everybody would go out to the same bars and the same restaurants. And I loved it. It was just kind of a blast. It was sort of summer camp.
That Game of Thrones universe, especially when you're looking at it as, you know, 4 writers coming from writing staffs that were obviously much larger. Did that teach you a whole nother skill set?
So David and Dan had not done television, to my knowledge. And they came into it and were kind of trying to keep it as bare bones as they could. Our writing room was very short. The first year it was a month, the second year it was a week, because we outlined a lot before we got there. But it made me think, wow, we're all making this a lot more complicated than it has to be. I just felt like they weren't doing a lot of things that were inessential. I think there's a lot of wasted time in writers' rooms. And these guys were sort of like down to business, like, okay, let's go, let's do this thing. We don't want to sit here for the rest of our lives. Part of what it taught me is like, just get on with it and do it. You don't need to make it so ridiculously hard or time consuming.
I think it's fascinating that they read Hope Spring. That's what they looked at,
yeah,
in Game of Thrones. So
I find people talk a lot about sort of the difference between genre writing and whatever else there is, I guess regular writing or non-genre writing. But I've never seen that big a difference. Like, to me, it just feels like, okay, in genre, there's more possibilities for the physical world. But all the emotional underpinnings of the world are still the same. Everybody else was surprised that they hired me off Hope Springs, whereas I was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
You're off Game of Thrones and you are looking for your next thing to do, and you get a call from the guy who gave us Hellboy.
The Guillermo call kind of came out of nowhere. I think he knew that I had worked on Game of Thrones, and that show has opened so many doors because it encompasses so many different types of writing. And I think people feel a certain confidence when you've come from there that you can handle certain types of material. He had already begun the process of writing, but he wanted someone to sort of help him take it home. So that's what we did.
I thought it was ironic that your first meeting was at a sushi restaurant.
Apparently he met everyone at sushi restaurants. I think he was really into this fish thing. I don't know. He told me his story, which I thought was super interesting. At first, when he started pitching it to me, I thought, oh, it's a period piece. And then I realized, oh, it's a fairy tale. Once I realized that, I felt very comfortable with it. I felt like, okay, I get what he's going for. And he had enough tonal references that I could kind of place what he wanted. Not only did I love the story, but I felt like I was meeting a filmmaker at a moment in his life and career where he had something he loved and he really, really felt compelled to do it. And he maybe had had certain circumstances where he was less engaged in his work or less happy with what he was doing. And this was a real turning point for him and a real moment. It just seemed like such an opportunity to be a part of that with him. There's so many different kinds of people who are directors. It takes so much personality and confidence, I think, to be a director. And Guillermo is this person who is just almost 100% pure creative spirit. He's not naive, but he's not at all caught up in box office or this or that. He doesn't have a lot of ego about him. He's all about, like, this is the thing I want to do. I love this monster. I want people to see it. And I thought that was exciting.
Well, so I think I read somewhere that he gave you basically more like an outline.
He had like maybe 20, 25 pages of script material. And then the rest of it was sort of outlined in a pretty loose way. And I'm not even sure I was aware we were starting work. And the person who was my contact with him was like, okay, so come to the next meeting and bring your pages. And I was like, my pages of what? So I just started writing pages off the outline. And it was really fun. In the beginning, I was sort of trying to guess at the tone.
How did you get into that groove in writing in a tone that really was more in his mind?
The period element helped. And he talked to me about being inspired by the work of the Coen brothers. And I kind of got the idea that what he meant was we were writing a movie about these two people who can't talk. So they're silent. And then all around them, there's all this talk, which is very specific and interesting, but not the emotional core of the film. Core of the film is silent. And so that to me really made sense and made me, and he talked a lot about sort of why he said it in the particular time period and certain things about that. And so I felt like I had a good thematic understanding of what he was looking for in order to color in what all that talk was. But I just really enjoyed it. I found it sort of fun and very flavorful to have all this sort of weird 60s talk about whatever it was, Cold War, they were talking about. I knew from the very beginning, like, it just had a fun to it.
Where did all of this character development come from for all the talky people? How did that backstory develop all around them? Can you talk about that?
He talked about the idea that this was about all these outsiders. At one point, I tried to sort of dig in and be like, now who specifically are these military people? Like, what's their relationship to each other? What branch of the military are they in? Who are they reporting to? What are they actually doing? And as soon as I asked him the questions, I realized, like, oh, I've taken all the magic out of his thing. Like, he was sort of like, you know, and I just thought, oh, never mind, forget it. Like, I'll just make it up. And if it's wrong, he'll tell me. After that, I just worked on it more from the perspective of, like, who do I think this guy is with these black fingers? And, like, he's this horrible person, but he believes in the future. And, like, it was more of a feeling and a theme at that point, because I thought, oh, I get it. He wants it to be more that. He wants this guy to represent something as opposed to be a very specific sort of figure. And that's, in that way, having it be a fairy tale was so freeing, because I felt like, well, that's okay. Like, in a fairy tale, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't care if he's a Marine or who he is. Like, it really could be anything.
But he seemed to have really a lot of the very humorful scenes in the film. I mean, how did you use him? It feels like you used him as the backbone for the story that's going on around the silence.
I would say that some of that humor came later in the process as Guillermo was heading into production. As I was writing Strickland, I feel like he was a little bit darker, and I think Guillermo sort of lightened him up later on to maybe add tonal variation and to get at something more specific about that time period. In my mind, he was just this sort of really dark guy with a cattle prod, and I really liked, I feel like in some ways I may have gone a little too dark because I was so excited about how dark he was. I just kind of enjoyed the purity of his nastiness and the specificity of it.
Look, don't touch. That lovely dingus right there is an Alabama howdy-do. Molded grip handle, low current, high voltage electric shock cattle prod. Name's Strickland, security.
Flynn security.
Oh, no, a man washes his hands before or after tending to his needs. It tells you a lot about a man. He does it both times. Points to a weakness in character. Ladies? It was very pleasant chatting with you both.
So your process of working with him was really interesting. You moved into a completely different way of writing with him, but it was co-writing for sure. So can you talk about how you guys worked that process? Because I don't think that's the norm out there.
Yeah, I think it is the norm for him. And I actually really enjoyed it. But at first I was surprised by it and sort of confused. So like I said, I turned in these pages and then he turned in some pages. And then we sort of went back and forth until there was a full draft. And then after that, we would go back and forth with the draft. And he had explained to me the process, which is like, if you have the script, I don't write anything. If I have the script, you don't write anything. So he would like text me or call me, I guess email me on like a Wednesday and say, you'll get the script tomorrow. I want it back Monday. And so I only ever had 4 or 5 days at a time. It was really interesting because I felt like in much the way sort of David and Dan taught me that you don't have to be so complicated and laborious, Guillermo taught me that you don't need as much time as you think you do. And I would ask him, what are the parameters of my draft? So do you want a polish? Do you want a full revision? I can tell you what I think you want or need, but what do you want? Then I would send it back to him and I wouldn't hear anything for like a month. And I was like, I don't know, maybe I was fired. You know, it was so weird. I was like, oh, well. And then I'd get an email, tomorrow you will have the script. So that was how it went.
He's such a visionary director, and I would imagine an awful lot of what he is envisioning is not on the page. How did you work within that, though, to try to be meeting, you know, what you think is going to happen?
I think he described all the actions that you see. What he couldn't have described to you or didn't describe to you is that, like, there's all this color coding in the movie, and there are all these filmic references, some of them to films I've never seen and didn't know were being referred to in the film. So there are times when I wished I had been in more communication with him so I could have known about things I no doubt was tripping over. But I'm positive that that was purposeful on his part because he didn't need me to embrace whatever he was referring to. He needed my perspective on the writing of the script.
So you had this great, comfortable collaboration with somebody and a unique way of working. What do you think about each of you contributed to that being such a positive collaboration?
I sort of saw it as a challenge and a bonus to be in this strange collaboration where we weren't having a lot of conversations. I also think he wanted me to be, even though I feel like now in hindsight, like I tripped over all these things that I didn't know he was doing, I think he needed someone confident to be in that partnership. But he is just an incredibly generous and egoless artist himself. And I think probably that's what makes these things possible.
What are some of the scenes in that movie or pieces that you felt added to it that weren't in his original 20-some pages?
I loved writing Strickland. Not all my stuff stuck, but I wrote scenes for him that we didn't even need because I was like, oh, he's so great. I just want to see him do these terrible things. And I also thought at a certain point, he had such weird scenes in there sometimes, and I thought, Guillermo needs me to be equally creative and unrestrained. So I would just toss in these crazy scenes to be like, see, look, I could be crazy, you know. But I felt like he really was asking for a level of freedom and sort of unrestrained creativity that if I didn't try to match it, if I wasn't bold about it in saying, hey, I might fall on my face, but here's this crazy thing, that I would really be letting him down.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan.
We're back with The Shape of Water co-writer Vanessa Taylor. The Shape of Water was the most nominated film at the 2018 Academy Awards and ended up winning 4 awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. When we left off, Taylor was discussing the unique collaboration she had with director Guillermo del Toro.
On the love story part, how were you going about developing that relationship, thinking about beforehand how you were going to make this work for the audience?
You know, it was really interesting. I actually remember part of restructuring things. You know, there's a whole sequence where she's like playing him music and bringing him eggs and doing all these things. And I remember at one point I was sitting there restructuring, like, is the egg first or the music first or the thing first? Like, just because it didn't have words didn't mean it wasn't the development of a relationship. They were having communication. So I was just trying to show the emotional evolution of it in a way that I felt like it was escalating. It all had to feel like it was going along in the way that it would if it had words.
I thought the friendships that she had were some of the really richest part of the film. Was that something they were always in the original piece that he gave you, or did you have to fill out some of these characters to help the silent character get further through the script?
Right. I think there were certain moments where there was some conversation about, like, do we have enough for both of these people to do? Should there only be one person? Would that be better? But of course, if you have a lead who can't speak, you've got to have somebody there. So there's no chance of not surrounding her with people. Guillermo knew this from the beginning, but that these people would also embody this sort of other, and that they were struggling with these issues of being very marginalized, and that in a time in America when everybody thought it was Camelot, these people still felt very left out and less than and excluded. And that was part of their friendship, because of course she, you know, feels that way too.
I mean, would you say that you basically were looking at it as an adaptation in a way off of something that he already had? Or
So it wasn't a straight adaptation, but I would say that that love story came in so fully formed, and so much of this visually was fully formed. You know, the imagery of the egg and the water in her apartment, and there was clearly, Guillermo had had this in his mind for a long time. And so there were certainly parts of this that I feel like I almost didn't touch at all. I did touch the love story in the sense that I tried to think about what her arc would be around having to contemplate maybe saying goodbye to a love relationship. And so I certainly had my hands in it, but I really felt like some of this had just, when I saw the cut for the first time, I just thought, oh, he really, really knew from a long time ago sort of what that would be.
You've clearly done this before, worked with a lot of characters. There are a lot of characters in that film that actually have a lot of screen time. So even though it's centered around these two unspeaking creatures, how to know when you have too much, when you're losing your main story? Like, I would imagine that was somewhat in Divergent too.
Although with Divergent, you know, when you're adapting a super popular book, you have almost no latitude at all. You could try to kill off a character. I think I did try to kill off a character. And they were like, so you don't have as big a problem, because even if it doesn't really work for a script, they're like, we don't care. It's the same as a book. It's great. Whereas with something like this, you have to actually make it work and sort of unify these things. And I do think we tried to do a little work there in terms of having Zelda be in scenes. So we had to do some work to integrate that and make it feel like there was a reason for her to be there and it all made sense. But yeah, it's a little bit of juggling. That was sort of part of the fun of it.
I want to go back to that nonverbal communication between them, because I did think it was really interesting how that got woven in there. There's an awful lot about the creature that's left to our imagination. And I'm assuming that was intended.
I think so. And I also think there's a lot about her that's left to our imagination. And the fact that she doesn't talk makes it much easier in my mind for her to be something of a fairy tale creature. I always felt like if she were to talk, we'd get into all these super weird questions. But because she doesn't talk, you kind of skate past that a little bit. And she's allowed to be mysterious in a way that I think really helps you at the end when you're feeling like, oh, this is a fairy tale.
Yeah. Well, and so the voiceover, was that the first time you'd ever worked in that realm?
The irony here is that on Everwood, I was known as the voiceover queen. Like, I wrote all the voiceovers. I was totally into it. And in this movie, every time Guillermo put in a voiceover, I cut it. I was like, no voiceover. Don't need the voiceover. I don't know what even this is talking about. Like, I don't get it. I don't understand why we need it. And then when I saw the cut, it was really interesting because he had changed the voiceover slightly. And so it did two things. One of them I felt like the earlier voiceover didn't do, and the other one I felt like I just didn't catch. So the first one was, it establishes that it's a fairy tale and the tone of the piece. And the second one is, it kind of tells you, this is going to be Beauty and the Beast, but it's going to be turned on its head a little bit. And so I was really a little bit humbled by that, like, I cut this so many times. And ultimately, I feel like it made the film better. At the end voiceover, there is a poem. And for all the times Guillermo sent me this voiceover, there was a different poem. And then when I finally saw the cut, he had this new poem that was perfect that he claims he found. It was like one day they were shooting in Toronto and he was early to set and they went to a bookstore and he found a book and opened it to the page of this Rumi poem. I mean, it was such a crazy story. And I was like, okay, I don't know. It was beautiful. And I felt that it was so perfect for that moment.
If I told you about her, what would I say? That they lived happily ever after? I believe they did. That they were in love? That they remained in love? I'm sure that's true. But when I think of her, of Eliza, the only thing that comes to mind is a poem whispered by someone in love hundreds of years ago, unable to perceive the shape of you. I find you all around me. Your presence fills my eyes with your love. It humbles my heart, for you are everywhere.
Giles and Zelda, though, are, I mean, they could almost have had a movie of their own. Were they both originally in his story? Was it meant to be that specific kind of character? I mean, they were both clearly outsiders.
Where the sort of changes happened most in the script is Giles was always meant to have this unrequited passion for this pie guy, but there were many versions of this pie guy thing. In one version, pie guy beats him up. In another version, the creature hurts pie guy. And then there's like less pie guy, there's more pie guy. I just think Guillermo really wanted this thing about him, but also about the future and the way in which they're thinking about the future, and the future is green and he's getting phased out. He's part of the past, and it all sort of fit in for him thematically.
Okay, so who wrote the cat scene?
Who wrote the cat scene? So there were also, I'm embarrassed to say, many versions of the cat scene. At one point, I had Giles like giving her a kitten, and then the creature eats the kitten, and then there were lots of kittens. Because we had this question of like, how much does this creature have to do to threaten her feelings for him?
Do you really enjoy the process of working specifically with a director? You know, when you wrote Hope Springs, that was all your own, right? And then...
So Hope Springs is sort of a different animal because I knew really clearly in my mind what that was. So I loved writing it by myself because I knew all the answers. But I haven't subsequently had something like that where I felt like I had such ownership of something and felt so inspired to write something. And for a long time, I tried to find something that would be similar and I just didn't find it. That was when I finally thought, okay, I'll just see what ideas other people have. And that really opened me up to a lot of great new experiences. So I hope someday I'll have another idea that I really want to write by myself. I would love to do that. It's just in the absence of that, I'd like to work on things with directors I respect and have sort of a collaboration and exchange of ideas and just try to keep getting better at it. I find that I am challenged every single time. I've never met the screenplay that was easy to write. People are always sort of saying like, well, you should just take this job. It'll be sort of easy money. It's like this cheesy script about whatever. The cheesy ones are just as hard as the other ones. It doesn't work out the way they say. Every single time I feel like I make one mistake and I learn that one, and then there's a new mistake to make the next time. But over time, I've become better at structure, and I find real joy in knowing the answers some of the time. Because in the beginning, I remember very firmly knowing the answers none of the time, and that was a drag. And now, to at least kind of know what I don't know and sort of be able to place myself a little better really makes it a much more fun and interesting experience.
In TV, you're in a room, you're still involved with what ends up on the screen each week, whether it's 12 or 20, however many episodes. But in film, I mean, you weren't on the set, right? For
No, I wasn't on the set at all. And so a weird thing happens in television, right? You're going along being a writer and you're like hoping to get these promotions. And then at some point people are like, now you're a producer. Now you should know about wardrobe and casting and post. All these things that like you may or may not know anything about, but now you're going to have to learn about them and you're going to be consulted on them and people are going to value your opinion about them. And I think a lot of writers really enjoy expanding in that way, but I really didn't. I'm an introvert. I don't want people to ask me about casting and wardrobe. Like I am not under the impression that I know anything about those things. I mean, I learned to have some skills ultimately as a producer because I did it for a long time, but it's not where my talent lies. And so I never particularly sought out being that kind of all-around producer. And there is a moment on the film side, no doubt, where you finish this thing, you think you've done a great job, and the director comes and you never see it again. Like, they're gone, they're on set, they don't care about you, you're like done. I certainly feel disappointed by that sometimes, or I more left out. You just feel like, oh, boo. But I think I probably would choose it over having to be responsible for every single aspect and having that take me away from what I really want to be doing, which is learning to write better.
In particular, in The Shape of Water, was so astounding. I mean, you literally are in another world. How did that feel when you first saw it?
It is such a strange thing to have been so intricately involved in something and then to suddenly not be and to watch it as an outsider. And the other weird part was, of course, I had never met anyone involved with it other than Guillermo. So when I got to the Toronto Film Festival, I was walking on stage for a panel and Michael Shannon turned around and I was like, hi, I'm Vanessa. I wrote the film with Guillermo. And he was like, oh, hi. I mean, they were all super friendly, but it was absolutely bizarre because it was like, hey, I'm here. I'm super random. You have no idea who I am. And now we're going to be on stage. And the cast was the greatest. They were so inclusive. Even that day, Octavia was like, well, what Vanessa and Guillermo did so well. And I was like, oh my God, we've never met. But it's weird. It's definitely weird. It's a choice you make, you know.
So you've gone from that world now to Aladdin. So you then went into the Disney universe. I mean, that's a whole nother level. There are not even people to act it out.
It was super fun to just be a part of it. It just kind of walked in the door and I was like, cool, that sounds cool. And it just turned out to be such a blast. And I hadn't known anything about musicals. At one point I went to London and Alan Menken, the composer, was there and they were all working, and Pasek and Paul, who did La La Land, and we were all going to work on the music. And Alan was like, so have you worked in musicals before? And I was like, no. And I could tell he was like calculating, like, I need her to understand what she has to do. And the next day he came to me and was like, see this scene? It has like 8 lines. So there's only music for 4 lines. And I was like, okay, cool. Can you put more music there? And he was like, no. I was like, oh, okay. So there's going to be 4 lines. I got it. But it was really fun. It was like this great new sort of experience. It was a blast.
Can you talk about the scene?
Yeah,
the bathroom?
The scene where the creature comes out of the tub and she's plugging the doors so that the room is going to fill with water was always in the movie. So much of this imagery with water, Guillermo had just had from the very beginning, her floating in her apartment. Most of the water scenes were dry for wet, so they were shot in smoke and then water added after the fact.
So what films did he have you watch for your education?
I don't think he had me watch any films. He himself has talked about a documentary, and I'm not going to remember the name, that he watched and listened to that took place in 1962. I think it was merely for sort of the vernacular of the time. But I did watch the Coen brothers film, Llewyn Davis, because he had mentioned it. It takes place, I think, in the same year or very close. I wanted to watch it just in terms of tone to make sure I was understanding the reference he was making. But I really do wish I had watched Creature from the Black Lagoon. That's just ridiculous. Guillermo has spoken often about the fact that he was so inspired by that film and that he saw it, I believe he said, when he was 6, and that he really was very hopeful that those characters were going to get together in a romantic way, and that he felt like it had sort of been cheated. And so now this was his resolution of that love story.
And when you were writing the script, were any of these people mentioned cast-wise at all?
Totally. He talked about from the very beginning, he was like, okay, so it's Sally Hawkins. And I talked to Sally about it. He talked about Octavia. He didn't talk about Richard because I think initially it was Ian McKellen, but he talked about Michael Shannon. So yeah, he had a pretty specific idea already.
So structure, though, is really important for you.
Definitely. And I'm not a natural to structure. So I've really painstakingly tried to improve my skills. It continues to be very, very challenging. But, you know, it's important when you look at something and it falls apart. You know, there are movies that don't need complicated structure. Hope Springs had very little structure. But most of the time, you can kind of identify a structural problem. And part of what I think helps in that process is to give yourself permission to fail in a really big way. And to be like, today I wrote 10 pages that are terrible, and not to get down about it, but to be like, that's part of the process. I'm just looking for the thing. I'll find it. You know, I didn't find it today. If you are telling it well, each scene should need to be there. So I think it's a matter of learning to feel that momentum, and like a person should be reading the script wanting to know what happens next. If they hit a scene where they don't, that scene should go. I'm really, really inspired by Michael Clayton, the screenplay by Tony Gilroy. And every time I read it, I think, oh, I've got to write something just like Michael Clayton. And then I think, someone already wrote Michael Clayton. And then I think I just want to be the person who wrote Michael Clayton. But I find it incredibly inspiring. The fact that it even exists, the fact that such a brilliant, suspenseful film of such beauty and meaning exists makes me feel like, okay, there's like a shining goal out there.
What are you looking to do now? Like, what have you gotten from all these different experiences?
I really love film, and I love the lifestyle of film. Like, I love everything about it. Everybody's headed the other way, and I totally get why they are. And partly, I think, you know, the status of the writer is so much higher in television. I was so much more important when I worked in television. And you really get treated like you're the big boss, and you really matter. And on the film side, you are really treated like you do not matter. But I really love movies. I love the challenge of making the structure work once. I don't need to make it work 26 times or 12 times. Really, for me, it's about each project just being something that feels challenging, that there's a little bit of a sense of like, can I do this? You know, when I started Game of Thrones, I was really frightened, but there's excitement in that too. You know, now I'm working on Hillbilly Elegy, which is an adaptation of a memoir. And so probably after that, I'll look to do something quite different. The reason I love to work in sort of sci-fi and fantasy is because of that what if element. I'm sure I'll try to go back to that. But who knows? I'm really open to what opportunity presents itself. I've really recently been more into, let's just see what walks through the door. You know, I was so lucky when Guillermo walked through the door, and it was only because I was open to doing it and I wasn't so set on. Prior to that, I think I had been much more like, I have to do this. I'm trying to do that. And then when I finally was like, whatever, I don't know what I'm trying to do. Let's just see who shows up. It became a much better, happier experience.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October.
PRI, Public Radio International.